minus 2n pn plus n plus 1 pn plus 1. And so the point about this, so this is again, so pn here is the probability that there are n particles in the system at time t. And so this is the dynamical equation that describes the evolution of the probability distribution. And so what I did last time is I specialized to the case of the pure birth process, in which everyone gives birth asexually, and so we just all keep reproducing at some rate, but nobody dies. And so in this particular case, our equation of motion is Pn dot is equal to n minus 1, Pn minus 1 minus n, Pn. So all that's happening here is I'm always just going like on the one-dimensional line. Here is n. You know, here is 0, 1, 2, 3. And so there's a rate of hot. Well, if there's nobody, you can't. If there's nobody, nothing happens. But if you start with one particle, you just reproduce. And here, because there's two particles, the reproduction rate is twice as big. Here, because of three particles, the overall reproduction rate is three times as big, and so on down the road. And so that is the equation of motion. And so last time I showed you how to use the generating function approach to solve for the probability distribution. And what we found for the pure birth process is that Pn of t is equal to e to the minus t, 1 minus e to the minus t to the power n minus 1. And so I want to spend a few minutes now just discussing some of the physical implications of this result, because yeah, it looks very simple, but it's actually there's many striking features about it. So first point is that this is what might be called an ultra-wide distribution. And why I say that is let's look in the limit of large n. So when n goes to infinity, well, since we're all friends here, n and replacing n minus 1 by n, well, that's no big deal. If n is a million, who cares if it's a million or a million one? So let's replace it by n. And now in the limit of long times, you know, because, well, so first of all, here's maybe point zero. N average is equal to e to the t. That's sort of obvious just from the average rate equation, which says that n dot is the rate of change of n is proportional to n itself. And so the solution for that is e to the t. But so the point is that in the limit of large n and long time limit, so when time is long, this is a small correction here. This is tiny. And so 1 minus this, we can write as e to the minus this whole thing here. So in the limit of n going to infinity, Pn of t is going to be asymptotically equal to e to the minus t. And so I replace 1 minus e to the minus t by e to that thing. And so that's e to the minus t, and then times n with the minus sign. So it's this thingy. And this I can write as e to the minus t, e to the minus n over n star. So the point is here that the distribution is decaying exponentially in n. And normally say, well, exponential decay, that's fast exponential. But the characteristic scale of the decay, n star, is equal to e to the t. So yes, it's decaying exponentially in n. The distribution is monotonically decaying as n gets larger, but it's decaying so incredibly slowly such that the average value is actually e to the t. So it's very difficult to plot this function because it's basically flat out to e to the t. So that's point number one. Another important point is if I now look at n squared. Well, let's look at the moments. So what I mean by moments of the distribution is that normally one defines, like for example, let's call this mk is equal to n average to the power k. So the kth moment of the distribution, this is how we normally write it. And so the first moment is just the average number of particles. The second moment is n squared. And the variance is going to be n squared average minus n average squared. So it's the second moment minus the first moment squared. And we're typically interested in the square root of that thing, which is sort of the standard deviation. let's look at the standard deviation for this process. So let's calculate, for example, n average, which is equal to summation from n equals 1 to infinity of n pn. We already know the answer, because just from sort of like looking at the average behavior, we know that that grows as e to the t. But let's just do the calculation, because that'll help us do the calculation for higher moments. So the thing is that here, I can write this just to make life a little bit simpler. Let's call this whole thing here capital little x, because this makes notational simpler here. This is going to be the summation n equals 1 to infinity n, and then I have e to the minus t, which doesn't have an n in it, and then I have x to the n minus 1. And so this I can write as, let's factor out to e to the minus t out in front. And again, to do like summations of this type where there's an n out in front, you differentiate with respect to, you treat this as now a parameter that you can differentiate with respect to. And this is nothing more than d by dx, summation from 1 to infinity of x to the power n. And you see that when I do differentiation, it brings down a factor n. I have x to the n minus 1. It produces exactly this guy here. So now I can do this summation trivially, because this is nothing more than e to the minus t d by dx. And then this thing is equal to x divided by 1 minus x. And even this I can differentiate without a mistake, I hope. So when I differentiate this, I'll get 1 over 1 minus x. And then when I differentiate the denominator, I will get plus x over 1 minus x all squared. And then I can combine this, and I'm just going to get 1 over 1 minus x squared. But if x is this, 1 minus x is e to the minus t. So this is e to the minus t downstairs, which is e to the plus t upstairs squared. And so this is just equal to e to the t. So as advertised, the average number goes like e to the t. And then I can compute things like n squared. And so to compute n squared, well, this is nothing more than summation n squared dn. And so here I'm going to have, so I can write this as n times npn. And so for the first summation, well, here, let me just sort of, I argue that this is going to be d by dx, x, d by dx, summation n equals 1 to infinity, e, n, x to the n, pn x to the, crap, where is my, yeah, so, okay. So this guy over here was e to the minus t x to the n minus 1. So, yeah, sorry, over here. Okay, so what I want to compute, I'm sorry that I'm getting myself a bit lost here. So what I want to compute here, okay, let me go back one step, sorry. So I have n times e to the minus t x to the power n minus 1. And so I argue that the way I can do this is precisely what I wrote down and then erase. So this is nothing more than d by dx, x d by dx of summation e to the minus t x to the n minus 1. Let's factor out the e to the t because it's distracting me. E to the minus t summation x to the power n. So when I differentiate once with respect to x, I bring down one factor of n. I multiply by x, it makes this back to x to the n. I differentiate one more time, I'll bring down two powers of n, and now x to the n minus 1, so that's this line over here. Sorry for like messing that up. But anyways, I'm not going to do the rest of this because I can already see I'm going to get myself lost. But you know, it's a simple calculation. And let me just tell you what the answer is. The answer is e to the 2t equal to twice e to the 2t minus e to the t. That's n squared average. And so the thing that we might be interested in is the standard deviation. Which is nothing more than the square root of n squared average minus n average squared. And because of the 2 that's sitting out in front here, when I compute n squared average and subtract away n average squared, there's still a term of order e to the 2t left out in front. This is going to be equal to e to the 2t minus e to the t. And at the long time limit, we can forget about this compared to the e to the 2t. So this asymptotically goes like e to the power t. So what it says is that the fluctuations in the number are as big as the average value. So if, you know, I run my pure birth process, and one time I'll get 1 million particles, and the next time I get 10 million particles, and the next time I get 1 billion particles. And if the n average is like 1 billion, then sometimes they'll get 1 billion, sometimes they'll get 5 billion, sometimes they'll get 50. It can be anything you want because the size of the fluctuation is the same as the average itself. So it means that the distribution is so broad that the average value really has no meaning. And that's sort of a very important lesson that one has to appreciate in a lot of these statistical mechanical problems, which is that there's systems in nature where the size of the fluctuation is of the order of the size of the system itself. And so like what you learn in like classical statistical mechanics, that you know you have a system which is extensive and fluctuations can be neglected. In this situation, fluctuations are huge and play an important role in the characterization of the system. So I think that's everything I wanted to say about the pure birth process. So any questions with this?
Can you explain again why you get in the second column there, how do you get 1 minus e to the power of negative? Like that, how did that practice turn into e to the power of negative n, e to the power of negative e?
Here. You know, I see, going from here to here. Okay, so the point here is that this object, I mean, you know, here we have 1 minus, in the long time limit, this is a very small number. So let's call it 1 minus epsilon. And so when epsilon is small enough, I say that the very first term in the power series expansion of this is the same as the power series expansion of that. And that's all I'm doing. Anything else? Okay. Let's see, what else did I want to say about this, if anything? Oh, yeah. So now let's talk about the good old...
Next question.
Yeah, please.
So the fluctuations in the population are... I think what you said is... at one point, there might be people being born. At another point, maybe 1 billion people being born.
Well, I mean, I was being a little sloppy. What I should have said is that if the average number of the size of the population on average is 1 billion, then if I do many realizations of the process, in one realization I might get 1 billion, another realization I might get 1.8 billion, another realization I might get 100 million, but the size of the variation is the same as of the order of 1 billion. That's the correct statement.
Yes. Mm. So there is a non-zero probability that you get a very small number?
Yes. Well, again, if I go back here, you know, where this distribution is this object here. So I plot this distribution. This is as a function of n. This is pn at any given time. So at n equals 1, you know, that's where this thing is decaying monotonically with n. So this is a distribution which is decaying. It's just that this decay length is e to the n. But the most likely event is that my one particle that I started with decided I'm going to be lazy and not even bother reproducing. So it just sits there doing nothing. That's the highest probability event. Yeah. So it's weird. It's a weird system. Okay, but now let's go to the birth-death process. The full birth-death process. And I'm not going to go through the details of solving the problem. It's every single step that I did last time in class, you can do it one step by step and follow everything, and you'll get the same solution. I mean, you'll get the following equation, which is that starting with the master equation, the generating function satisfies dp by dt is equal to z minus 1 squared dp by dz. And then if you go through everything I did last time in class, what you'll find ultimately is the following answer. Pn of t is equal to t divided by 1 plus t to the power n minus 1, 1 over 1 plus t squared for n larger or equal to 1. And p0 of t is equal to 1 over 1 plus t. So you have slightly different answers for n equals 0. And here, n equals 0 is now a non-trivial part of the state space because you can, like, having zero particles in the system is like the system has gone extinct. And so it's an interesting question to ask. What is the probability that the system goes extinct? So this distribution is very different in character than for the pure birth. In pure birth, you just run away, you know, to like exponentially large in time. But here in the birth-death process, what we have, if I'm plotting as a function of n, the transition rates, well, if I'm at a point here n, there's sort of an arrow of length n going to the left or to the right. If I'm down here near 1, you know, it's an arrow of length 1 going to the left or to the right. So the point is that this random walk is getting faster and faster the further out to the right that you go. And so out here where there's lots of people, well, if there's a million people, each one gives birth at rate 1 and each person dies at the rate 1, there's like 2 million events happening. Whereas down at 1, where there's only one person, it's kind of lazy and not much is happening. One event is happening per unit time. So it's like nothing more than a good old random walk, but the rate at which things are hopping is speeding up as you move further to the right. But so what I want to do now is I just want to discuss some of the features of this process because it's also very different than the pure birth process. So let's look at, for example, the distribution itself. So this is now plotting as a function of n. En of t. And so let's call this guy y. And so you see that Pn of t is basically Pn of t is equal to 1 over 1 plus t squared, which doesn't depend on n, and then it's y to the power n. So this is just exponential decay. So it's just doing something like that. But it's not ultra-wide exponential decay, because the characteristic scale is no longer like e to the t, but if we look at this guy y, so y is equal to t divided by 1 plus t, and I can write this as 1 divided by 1 minus 1 over t, which I can write as roughly 1 divided by 1 plus 1 over t, which I can write as this is a plus sign here, this is a minus sign here. So this is e to the minus t. So y to the power n, and again, let's replace n minus 1 by n in the limit of large n. So this is nothing more than t over 1 plus t to the power n. So this is power n.
E to the minus 1 over t?
Yes, sorry. I'll get this right eventually. So again, this is correct. And now I do a Taylor series expansion of this. And this is 1 minus e to the n over t, which scales as e to the minus n over t. So this is what I'll define as e to the minus n divided by n star, where the characteristic decay length, instead of it being e to the t, is just t. So n star, the characteristic size, is equal to t. So it's a much more rapid decay because in addition to birth happening, death can happen. And so that gives rise to an exponential probability distribution. A couple of other things that are, so let me maybe make a little note here. So first of all, zero. 0.0, n average. Well, n average. Whoa. Well, let's actually calculate n average. So let's calculate n average. N average. That's equal to summation from n equals 1 to infinity of npn. And so let's do that calculation. So summation n equals 1 to infinity n. And pn is now what I'm calling 1 over 1 plus t squared. And now I have y to the power n minus 1. And so this is equal to 1 over 1 plus t squared out in front that I don't have to worry about because it doesn't depend on n. And then this is nothing more than d by dy of y to the power n, from n equals 1 to infinity. And again, the d by dy brings down the power of n and makes this power here n minus 1. So this is the same as what's up here. And so this is equal to 1 over 1 plus t squared. And then this is d by dy of 1 of y divided by 1 minus y. And then this is the same thing I did over here. And so this just turns out to be 1 over y squared. So this is equal to 1 over 1 plus t squared. And this is 1 over 1 minus y squared. And then y is t over 1 plus t. 1 minus y is 1 over 1 plus t squared. And so this magically is equal to 1. So n average is equal to 1. The average population size is 1. Amazing, isn't it? So even though, you know, people are giving birth and giving and whatever and dying, the crucial point is that this is a unbiased process. So I started my process with one particle. Here is one. I start with one person. Equally likely, this person can give birth, or equally likely, the person can die. And because of that event, there's no change in the average number of particles. And if I have 1,000,001 particles in the system, well, you know, one of the particles could give birth, or one of the particles could die. So in every single event, the average number of particles is fixed. So an average has to be fixed at 1. And if you're a mathematician, this process where what happens after one step of the stochastic process is identical to what happened before is called a martingale. So this process is a martingale, and that's why the average n is equal to 1. So that's interesting point number 1. But now we could look at n squared average, which is a measure of the fluctuations. So let's do that calculation. And again, because I sort of like was stumbling doing it over here, let me just say that you have to do the same thing, the same construction. And if you do that same construction, what you're going to find, and so I'm going to leave this for an exercise for you to do, this gives you 1 plus 2t. So what it's saying is that even though the average number of particles is fixed, the fluctuation is much bigger than the average number of particles. And in some sense, the fluctuation is kind of the natural scale of the process, because it's saying, like, what is the range over which the population size can be? So so this says, therefore, that n squared average minus n average squared, square root of all of this thing, is equal to square root of t, proportional to square root of t, just as in a random walk. Another important point is that extinction happens for sure. So we see that the survival probability of the population S of t, so this is defined as the survival probability, which is equal to 1 minus the extinction probability. 1 minus the extinction probability, but the extinction probability is the probability there is nobody left in the system. So that's 1 minus p0 of t. And so this is equal to there's a mistake here. this should be t over 1 plus t. The probability of going extinct goes to 1 in the long time limit. So the survival probability goes to 0. So this is equal to 1. This is equal to 1 divided by 1 plus t. So you're sure to die if you start like with an island with the one person and you just have everybody like undergoing unbiased birth-death process, eventually everybody's going to die. But again, it's in the same way as a one-dimensional random walk. If you ask how long does it take to die, it turns out to be infinite. Okay. Yes.
When we're solving for this problem, like the solution, did we have an initial condition that initially there's only one person?
Yeah, okay. Thank you for that question. Yes, so the solution here that I've written down, this solution is for Pn of t equals 0 is equal to delta n1. That is, I start with one particle. Generically, I typically always start an initial condition like that, one particle. If the number of particles initially is different, then you'll get a different solution. The main physical features don't depend on the initial condition. Yes?
If you take the derivative of the y,
Right. So this guy, if I do the y derivative, so I differentiate the y, I'll get 1 over 1 minus y. And the next term, I have the y upstairs, and I differentiate 1 minus y squared, I'll get 1 minus y squared. And then I combine this, and I get 1 over 1. Yeah. Yeah, so trust me, like, when I skip a step, I'm always going to skip a step that's trivial. You know, you might have to, like, do, like, 3 lines of algebra, but, you know, I'm not trying to hide anything yet. Yes. No, you look like you're ready to ask a question. No, you're not. Okay. Yes.
Why are we studying the birth death process?
Why are we studying?
Because it is similar to random walk.
Because it's a very prototypical non-equilibrium process, and in like lots of applications, one has like, say, viruses that are attacking your body, COVID, and the viruses are like reproducing and the viruses are being killed off. And so like this sort of birth-death dynamics is sort of ubiquitous in all kinds of non-equilibrium processes. So that's why I'm, and also the solution method is very generic and very broad. And yeah, so I think it's a very useful example to have in your.
So for a pure birth process,
yep.
If you had, let's say we're talking about viruses. If there was just one virus in your body and the probability that there is a big probability is that the virus doesn't do anything.
Right.
And if it does something, it's kind of unpredictable.
Well, it turns out, I mean, if we're talking about really typical viruses, what they do, I mean, it's a very strange thing because people are still debating, is a virus alive or not? Because, you know, normally, how do you define something as alive? You know, it should be, it has to reproduce, it has to consume energy, it has to, you know, have to produce waste, it's got to do something else that it's not, you know, is that enough to call life if it's something self-reproducing? Because the virus, what it does, something else, is that it, you know, attacks your cell, it hijacks a cell, it hijacks the, genetic code inside the cell, and it makes more copies of itself. So instead of the cell doing what it's supposed to be doing, it hijacks a cell and makes more copies of the virus, which then kills the cell, and then it spins, and the cell, like, sort of more or less explodes and puts up more viruses in the body that then attack more cells, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's not clear that that's alive or not, but that's basically the dynamics of a virus in your body.
Yeah, and
so one birth event comes with like 200 viruses or something.
Yeah. So you can think of it as a very bursty process. So in fact, I'll tell you a problem that's not solved. Suppose now that I do birth death in which I give birth to 2 children and I also die, but I die at twice the rate that I give birth, so that like the average population is fixed. you can go through all the same rigmarole and you'll end up that you can't invert. You know, like you can write down a differential equation for this thing and you can't invert it. And so it's an unsolved problem, as far as I know. But yes, I mean, people do a lot of modeling of viral dynamics where instead of producing one child to produce like a distribution of number of children at some rate, and people do all kinds of simulations and studies of these sorts of models. Yes.
How is this that the expectation value of n is always one, but long-term behavior is that they will go to p zero, like it will.
Yeah. So the point is that, you know, you see here that the survival probability is going down like 1 over 1 plus t. So in the very long time limit, you know, the survival probability is really tiny. But that the fraction of realizations of the process that have survived will have like lots of particles in them. And that's how you can have that the average number is fixed, even though like you're going to go extinct. It's the same way. I mean, you'll see something in my colloquium this afternoon that's like the same kind of dichotomy. And this dichotomy is what makes random walk problems still fascinating after 150 years of study. Okay, so this is one very simple type of dynamical non-equilibrium process. And what I want to do now is switch gears almost completely and talk about some very standard models of mathematical ecology or mathematical biology. So what I'm going to present now, you could think of as like Mathematical Ecology 101 or Mathematical Biology 101, but I just want to present some very generic types of population dynamical models because, first of all, there's lots of rich phenomenology, and it's also you're going to learn some, you know, interesting features about each of these systems. So let's now talk about dynamical systems. I don't know. Maybe to call it population dynamics. Population dynamics. So what I have in mind now is I have some population, which is, if I'm talking about a single species population, I'll have some density rho, and it changes in time according to some function which depends only on the density itself and nothing else. So this would be for like one species. Whereas if I have multiple species, like I could have rho 1 dot equal to some function of rho 1, rho 2. If I have two species in some kind of an ecosystem, rho 2 dot is some g of rho 1, rho 2. So this would describe two species. And so it's obvious like how to generalize this to like any number of species, n species. So these are what are called dynamical systems in the sense that they're time-dependent equations which don't involve time on the right-hand side. So it means that the evolution of the population depends only on the state of the population itself and not on, say, if there's global warming or global cooling or like a, you know, or a asteroid hits planet Earth and suddenly changes the environment. So we're imagining a fixed environment and that the population changes only according to like the environment itself, and that's it. And so for the one species case, it turns out that because there's only one differential equation, there's a very limited possibility of things that can happen. And so let me plot the different possibilities because there's very few of them. And so let's imagine that here I'm plotting my rho dot as a function of rho. And so because it's only a single equation, either rho dot is positive, negative, or zero. There's no other possibility. And so like, for example, let me show you the different possibilities. If rho dot is zero this way, this is what's called an unstable fixed point. Because notice that if I'm just to the right of the fixed point, rho dot is positive, and I'm driven away from the fixed point. If rho dot is negative, I'm sorry, if rho is less than the fixed point value, rho dot is negative, so I'm driven away. So this is an unstable fixed point. On the other hand, if my function looks something like that, this corresponds to a stable fixed point. Because if I'm just below the fixed point value F, rho dot is positive, so I'm driven to the right. Whereas if I'm above the fixed point value, rho dot is negative, I'm driven to the left, rho dot is negative. And so this is a stable fixed point. And then there's two other more flavors of fixed points. There's something that might look like this. And what's happening here is that if you have this very special case where your function comes to zero right like tangent to the origin, here, if I'm to the left of this fixed point, because like if I'm right at the fixed point, then I'm not going to move. But if I'm to the left, the flow is to the right because rho dot is positive. So I go to the right this way. But if I'm to the right of the fixed point, rho dot is still positive, so I'm driven away. So to the left-hand side, this is like a stable fixed point. To the right-hand side, this is an unstable fixed point. So this is called a saddle point. And the reason it's called a saddle point will become clear in just a moment when I talk about two dimensions. And the other type of saddle point is just going the other way, in which case it's stable coming in from the right. I'm flowing this away, and then I'm unstable going that away. And so there's these two flavors of saddle points. And this essentially describes the entire dynamics of a one-dimensional dynamical system. You typically, you flow until you reach a fixed point. When you get at a stable fixed point, you're stuck there forever, and that's the end of the story. So this is one dimension. Or one dimension or one species. Let's now look briefly at two dimensions, which corresponds to two species. And so in two dimensions, what you should think of then is that I have my rho 1, rho 2 dot as a function of rho 1, rho 2. So the vector rho 1, rho 2 dot, the change, is a two-dimensional, there's a two-dimensional surface, and rho 1, rho 2 dot is like the flow in the two-dimensional plane. So you should think of your dynamical system not as a curve in one dimension, but as a two-dimensional surface. And when this two-dimensional surface cuts the origin, that corresponds to a fixed point. And it turns out that in the case of two species, and here I'm just going to like be more like a zoologist and enumerate what are the different possibilities. The possibilities are, again, stable fixed point, an unstable fixed point. And then there's also saddle points. Saddle with two D's. And here, the reason why what I have in mind by a saddle point is that in a saddle point, what you should think of is like if you're hiking in the mountains and you're trying to climb to a pass between two mountains, it looks something like this. In one direction, it's going up, and in a orthogonal direction, it's going down. And so a saddle point corresponds to this is like cutting the origin. And in two directions, you're going uphill to the mountain peaks. And in the other orthogonal directions, you're going downhill to the valleys, to get your refreshments. Yes?
Yes. OK, for the birth of death process, could you maybe give an example of a saddle point?
For the birth death process?
Or for another process?
Well, okay, one thing is that birth-death process, notice this is discrete dynamics because, there's a discrete coordinate. So first of all, we have to go to continuous variables. So that's one thing. But then an example, for example, if I just say like x dot is equal to x to the power, x minus 1 to the power squared, for example, when x is equal to 1, that means that you have something that looks like that. So this is I'm plotting here x dot as a function of x. And so when x is equal to 1, this is equal to 0, and it comes and it's a parabola. And so this would be an example of this. But what does it correspond to, like ecologically or biologically? I don't know. Yeah. Okay. Anyways, so there's stable and unstable fixed points, there's saddle points, and then there's two more types of points that can exist in two dimensions. There are spiral points. And these can be both stable or unstable. So let me write it as un, brackets to denote both possibilities can exist. And what I mean by a spiral point is that if I'm looking in the two-dimensional state space and I'm looking at a trajectory, if here is a fixed point, the spiral point is something which the trajectory goes around and around in a circle and eventually hits the fixed point. So it's an oscillatory approach to the fixed point rather than like a monotonic approach to the fixed point, which is what happens in these sorts of examples. And in an unstable spiral, there'll be a fixed point, and if you're just a little bit away from it, you'll spiral away from it. And the last example are what are called centers. Whoops. This one. I'm confused here. No, I didn't want that. Let's see. Here. Yeah, so the last one is what are called centers. And centers are one where the orbits, there's a fixed point, and then you have periodic orbits that go around this. And they stay there forever. And so this essentially is the full characterization of all the possible dynamical behavior in a two-dimensional dynamical system. Some of the mathematics of working this out is a little bit hairy, and I'm not going to go to any of that, but I just want to give you a sense of all the different possibilities. If you now go to three dimensions, and here I'll just say a few general words about it. So if you have greater than two species, I'm sorry, greater than two species, so that means you're in a three-dimensional dynamical system or above. It turns out in this case, it's much richer and much more beautiful. The point is that in a two-dimensional dynamical system, if you look at the possible flows that exist in a two-dimensional dynamical system, there is something called the Poincaré-Bendixson theorem that says that if you have some kind of a two-dimensional flow that, you know, it there will be, you can always like sort of characterize a flow by an insider region and outsider region in the sense that, so I'm being very sloppy here. It's just that if you have flow in which is going in everywhere on the boundary of some region, then there's no way out. And so you can always characterize a flow by staying outside of this region or inside of this region. But once you're in three dimensions, if you can't get trapped in a two-dimensional region, because if you're sort of trapped, you can go out in a third dimension. And so in three dimensions, you can have all of this stuff here plus what are called strange attractors. And strange attractors is something which are akin to this, which is that you could have a situation where there's flow in some region, and it looks like it's going to go to a fixed point, but then you just escape in a third dimension. And so it's really cool because it's a much wider range of possibilities and very beautiful behavior. And in fact, this whole field really got a kick in the pants in the late 1950s or early 60s by a guy named Ed Lorentz, who came up with the Lorentz model, which is a very simple model for the weather. And so he developed a very simple three-dimensional dynamical system for three different variables that were coupled nonlinearly. And, you know, back in the 50s or 60s, you know, you had mainframe computers in the basement and you would, like, you know, run overnight. And so he, you know, he did, and, you know, you would just like look at the printout. And so he began some run one night and then he did the same thing the next night to check it. But apparently he mistyped one digit, like in the eighth decimal place as the initial condition. And then the next morning, the results were completely different. And that was the beginning of understanding like this behavior of strange attractors. And so it gave rise to this sort of quote that, you know, a butterfly flapping its wings in China can make a hurricane in Florida a week later. And so, you know, these are very sensitive dependence on initial conditions, chaotic behaviors. It's like a whole field of itself. It's really beautiful. I'm not going to talk about any of that though. I want to just live in the world of two-dimensional dynamical systems because they're much simpler and they also have lots of physical relevance. So that's kind of like a little qualitative tour. So let me now begin by actually discussing some basic models, like some concrete models. So the first model I want to discuss is logistic growth. So logistic growth, I imagine that I have a population of some organism that, say, like bugs, and bugs, they like to reproduce. But bugs will eat, you know, I don't know what bugs eat. What do bugs eat? People. I don't know. You know, bugs do whatever they do. But the point is that left to themselves, rho dot would be equal to rho. That would be like bugs are reproducing. But, you know, or let me go back up. Let's talk about something that's at the bottom of the food chain, but is a mammal, like little field mice. And so field mice, you know, they reproduce like mice because that's what mice do, but they eat grass. But, you know, if there's too many mice, they eat too much grass and there's no grass left for the babies to eat. And so there is like a population crisis. And so the simplest way of trying to account for that is by a term like this, a self-regulation term, rho minus rho squared. So this I can write as rho one minus rho. So this is called logistic growth. And so let's understand the dynamical behavior of logistic growth. And so to do that, the strategy in dealing with any of these dynamical systems is that first try and look for the fixed points, and then look at the null clines, which I'll define like this will happen a little bit later on in this lecture. And from them, you try and patch together and infer the global behavior. So without solving anything, we're going to learn a lot without actually doing explicit solution. So first point is notice that this equation is easily soluble because I could write this as d rho divided by rho 1 minus rho is equal to dt. And I can integrate this thing. So this is nothing more than d rho divided by 1 over rho. Let's see if I can get this right. 1 minus rho. Yeah, that's right. Good. dt. And so what I'm going to get here is log of rho minus rho 0 plus log of 1 minus rho, 1 minus rho 0. Rho 0 is the initial population, is equal to t. And so I can, you know, do something to solve for rho as a function of time. So, you know, so I'm going to get logarithm of rho times 1 minus rho, rho 0. 1 minus rho is equal to t. And so I can solve for rho of t. And you see I'm actually like stalling because I know I'm going to screw it up. And so let me, did I write it down somewhere? I don't remember. So I'm just going to not even bother because I'll screw it up. I'll just say you'll get this rho as a function of t. But you see, like this doesn't have any insight. You know, you're solving some equation. But let's get some insight by looking at the behavior of rho dot as a function of rho. And so that's our function. Here's 1. This is the function rho times 1 minus rho. And so from our general categorization, we already know immediately this is an unstable fixed point. So as soon as that there's any number of bugs in the system, no matter how small, if there's 1/1,000,000th of a bug, in this mean field approximation or this mean field-like description, there's a density. And the density could be infinitely small. There's no notion of like one bug or two bugs. There's no discreteness. There's like if there's a millionth of a bug, then the next time step there could be more than a millionth of a bug. So this is an unstable fixed point. This is a stable fixed point, and the flow is certainly going to here. And so we know that as t goes to infinity, rho goes to 1. And so that's the basic dynamical behavior. And if you write down rho of t here, you'll find that it decays exponentially in time to rho equals 1. So that is the simplest version of logistic growth. So let me, 9:53, why don't I stop for like 4 minutes? So if you want to run out, feel free. And I'll answer questions, but I won't lecture. Yes.
Please, about the strange attractors and sort of this, like when you're in three dimensions, the Poincaré-Bendixson theorem doesn't work anymore. And
right.
And this links to chaos, or not chaos, but like these strange attractors have this sensitive dependence on initial conditions.
Right.
Which could link to chaos.
Yeah.
But does this link to maps? Like if you express this continuous differential equation as like a discrete map, like xn plus 1 equals some f of xn,
right.
And you look and you're like, oh, does this have a horseshoe?
Right. Okay, well, so, I mean, one thing I did not say is that there's a really big difference between discrete maps and continuous maps. So even in one dimension, like the analog of the discrete version of this map here would be something like rho n plus 1 is equal to, say, some parameter lambda, rho n, 1 minus rho n. This equation has incredibly beautiful dynamical behavior that has much different than this behavior. I mean, this has both stable fixed points, unstable fixed points, 3 cycles, 2 cycles, infinite series of bifurcations, chaotic behavior. So the discrete map is very different in character than the continuous map. It's much richer, it's much harder to understand. But the behavior of this discrete logistic map is, you know, it's like I could give a whole course on just this, what the dynamical behavior of this map. So first point is that discrete systems are very different in character than continuous systems. And effectively, because if you were trying to take like the continuous limit of this, like you would say, well, let me do a Taylor series expansion. I'd say like take n and this call this delta n and do a Taylor series. But effectively, it's like you have to keep all powers of derivatives. And so effectively, it's a high dimensional dynamical system.
Accrued approximation of p dot as like pn plus 1 minus pn over 2, like some approximation, and then turn this, it wouldn't quite be that.
So I'm sorry, what are you, what?
As in, instead of writing p dot as pn plus 1, you could write like p dot as some crude sort of like tangent line, like p dot, pn dot would be instead like pn plus 1 minus pn over 2.
Right.
Those.
But you're saying, it seems like what you're saying is suppose I keep the next term in a Taylor series expansion. Yeah, but the point is that as soon as you add more terms in Taylor series expansion, you're increasing the dimensionality of the dynamical system by 1. And so every single more term you keep, you're essentially expanding the size of the dimensionality of the system. So, I mean, another example of the same kind of genre is suppose I had, here's a really simple one. Suppose I have rho dot is equal to e to the minus t. No, sorry. Rho dot is equal to minus rho of t. We know the answer to that. Rho is e to the minus t. No big deal. But now suppose I put a little time delay. What happens then? And it turns out it's magical what happens. If tau is small, it's kind of like exponential decay, but the longer tau gets, because you know, once you put tau here, like in principle, like you'd say, well, I have to expand this in Taylor series. But if I do a Taylor series expansion, keep every single term, you change the one-dimensional dynamical system into an infinite dimensional dynamical system. But if tau is very small, then it looks almost like exponential decay, but as tau increases, it changes from exponential decay to oscillatory decay to no decay at all. It's just magical and amazing what happens. And in fact, probably all of you have experienced this because, you know, you guys are young people. Hopefully none of you are like staying at the Ritz-Carlton when you go on your travels. You stay at some crummy hotel. You take a shower in the morning. You turn on the hot water. It's cold. Shit. Got it. You know. Turn on the hot water hotter, and all of a sudden you get scalded. Then you turn it out, and you know, it's like there's a time delay in that system. And because of that time delay, it really is hard to figure out how to control it. So I'm not sure I'm sort of like babbling. I'm not necessarily answering your question. Okay, so that's my 5-minute interlude. So where am I? Okay. Yes. So let's now look at some slightly more interesting examples which have natural applications to ecology, which is, let's suppose that I have two species, and suppose they're competing with each other, competition. So I have, you know, two different species, let's call them A and B. And for simplicity, let me just use A and B to denote the densities of each of these two species as well. So for example, A dot, if it's left by itself, is just doing logistic growth very happily by itself. But now let me put in that there's also another species B, B dot, and it's doing very merrily along its own logistic growth. And so if there was no interaction between these two guys, these would both go to density equals one. But now let's suppose that there is some kind of a competition. So like if I'm fighting for grass and Ali is fighting for that same blade of grass, there's some kind of negative competition between us going on that takes two of us to tango. And so there'll be a term which is quadratic in the density of me and the density of Ali. And so there'll be a minus epsilon AB. And let's make our competition symmetrical, that we're both equally strong, and so we both like sort of have the same number of scratches on our face after we fought, and so we have this. And now the question is, what is the behavior of this dynamical system? And so, you know, you can almost guess what might happen, but we're going to see it from the point of view of dynamical systems theory, which is that if epsilon is small, well, the density, when epsilon is zero, the density should be one. But when epsilon is small, well, the density should be maybe a little bit less than one because it's a more negative term happening here. But if epsilon gets too large and maybe the competition is so strong, something else might happen. So let's try and figure out what's going on. And so the strategy that we're going to adopt is that we're going to first find the null. So steps. So we're going to find the null cline. And I'll define what a null cline is in just a second. Find null clines. Two is find fixed points. And three is to infer the global behavior. So you'll see that we really don't solve anything explicitly in this approach, but it's the right way of dealing with two-dimensional dynamical systems. So the point here is that what is a null cline? Null clines are defined by one of the variables not changing. So there's two null clines, A dot equals zero, and B dot equals zero. So let's figure out where are the locuses where A dot equals zero, B dot equals zero. So A dot equals zero means that the right-hand side is zero. Question?
You said earlier that when epsilon is zero, the density is one. But which density are you talking about?
The density of A and B. Both of them are separately equal to one. Because if epsilon is equal to zero, these are two non-interacting populations, each of which is undergoing logistic growth, and both of them will just go to density equals one.
In the limit.
At the long time limit, that's right, yes.
Okay, so not at the beginning.
Yeah, in the beginning, they could be anything, as long as they're positive, yeah. Okay, so A dot equals zero implies, well, either A is equal to zero, which is kind of a trivial null cline, but there's also this curve here that B is equal to
minus A over epsilon A.
Thank you. B is equal to 1 minus A over epsilon. And the null cline B dot equals zero implies that either B is equal to zero, which sort of isn't the interesting case, and then A is equal to one minus B over epsilon. So let's look in the state space. And here our state space. So here is A and B. And the interesting regime is like, they're going to be restricted to be between 0 and 1, 0 and 1. And here's sort of the locus where A equals B. So A dot equals 0, so we have this curve. So when A, so let's try and figure out where this is. So when A is equal to 1 out here, B is equal to 0.
Isn't it 1 minus A over epsilon A?
No, because they're both, sorry. My mistake.
Oh.
Yeah, my mistake. And this is epsilon A, sorry. Yeah, because it's the A, there's already a quadratic because of this guy here. Sorry, that's my screw up. Okay, anyways, so yeah. So B is 1 minus A over epsilon. So we see that when A is equal to 1, B is equal to 0. And as A increases, B, as A increases, B also increases. And so there's some kind of a curve that looks like, say this. So this is the curve of B is equal to 1 minus A over epsilon. And now let's look at what happens on either. So the point is that on this curve, we have A dot equals 0. And so now we have to ask, what happens on either side of that curve? And so if we go a little bit to the right of this curve, if A is a little bit bigger, then what's going to happen? So that means that if, let's, I, you know, I could, I saw it before the lecture, I just checked and I could see it right away. Now I don't quite see it, but what I'm trying to figure out is what is the behavior of dA by dt? So if A is bigger, then yeah. So you can see from here that if I'm on the nocline, this thing is equal to zero. But if I make A a little bit bigger, then this is a more negative term. So that means that A dot is negative. So what it means here is that if I'm a little bit on this side, the flow is that away, and here the flow is this away. That's the crucial point. And that's the thing that takes a little bit of effort to try and figure out. But that's the local flow near this nocline. So that's a nocline A dot equals zero. But then there's a similar nocline over here. So when A is when B is equal to zero, A is equal to one, and there's a and it's sort of symmetrical. So let me try and draw it like that. So this is an nocline, B dot equals zero. And similarly, on this nocline, now I look at the local flow of B, and you can convince yourself that what's happening is that the flow is like this. So first point is that where the two noclines intersect, that means that simultaneously A dot equals zero and B dot equals zero. So that is a fixed point. So here is a fixed point. And so that's one of the reasons why solving for the noclines is useful, because you know sometimes a fixed point you have to solve two simultaneous equations, but graphically at least where the noclines intersect is where a fixed point exists. So there's where the fixed point is. And now what we need to do is figure out what is the stability about this fixed point. And so let's just try and look in different parts of this state space what's happening. So say in this region way down here, so we're to the left of this nocline, so the flow is to the right, and we're below this nocline, so the flow is up. So the flow is to the right and up. So in this part of the state space, the flow is looking something like that. Way out over here, well, I'm not allowed to go beyond one. So if I'm just in this little trapezoidal region here, well, we're to the right of this nocline. We're to the right of this nocline, so the flow is to the left. But we're above this nocline where the flow is down, so the overall flow is to the left and down. So that's what's happening over here. Now let's look in this little triangle that's between the two noclines. And so we're to the left of the B, A dot equals zero nocline, so the flow is to the left. But we're below this nocline where the flow is up. So this is to the left and up. So the flow is looking like that. And similarly here, in this nocline, we're above the B dot equals zero nocline, so the flow is down. We're to the left of the A dot equals zero nocline, so the flow is to the right. So the overall flow is to the right and down. And so this is what I was trying to say earlier on, which is that if you can find the noclines and then find the fixed points, and then infer the global flow by just looking at different parts of the state space, it's pretty clear here that the overall flow is such that this is a stable fixed point. And so this is a good spot where I need my computer now. So if you can bring down the screen, that would be really helpful. And let's see if I can. So what I'm about to show now is a mathematical plot that I'm just plotting that the flow diagram induced by those equations. So hopefully it's going to show up. So basically what I'm showing now in the plot is going to be, I had those equations A dot and B dot, and I'm just going to show like the flow, like I just look at a given point in the state space, I look at dA and dB, and here it is, great. And I have a little slider bar up here. So this is my epsilon, that's a little, can you see the E? And so let's start at zero, just for the fun of it. So when E is equal to zero, you see that the fixed point, everything, the flow is going to 1, 1. Both species are present and they're equally happy and they both go to 1. And as I increase my epsilon, so here's 0.1, and now you see that there's a fixed point, not at 1, 1, but it's roughly at 0.9, 0.9. So because of the competition, the species are doing a little bit less well because, you know, while we're trying to eat grass, some of us are killing each other off, like fighting for the grass, and so we're not doing so well. And then as you increase this competition parameter, that fixed point is getting lower and lower and lower. And you see something else dramatic happening, which is as I get now to 0.8, whoops, something weird happened at 1. What happened here? Wow. And then if I go beyond that, all of a sudden one sees that the fixed points, the stability of the fixed point changes character completely. And so the fixed point where both species are coexisting it's a saddle point. And if you have any asymmetry, whoever has just a little bit more strength wins out, and you'll be forced into the fixed points of either 1, 0 or 0, 1. So the point here is that if I continue this picture, so this whole picture here was for like epsilon small. If epsilon is larger than 1, let's just do that case now. This is now for epsilon larger than 1. So what you're going to find is that if I look at the null clines, the slope of this gets larger and larger. When epsilon is 1, the slope becomes less than minus 1. And so now my B dot equals 0 null cline is doing something like this. This is B dot. Can you guys see this? This middle one? Yes. You can see that okay? Yeah, so this is B dot equals 0. And the A dot equals 0 is doing something that looks like that. So here is the null cline A dot equals 0. And again, we have the same feature that here the flow is local flow. The null cline is doing this. For the A dot, it's doing something like this. And now we can sort of patch together what's happening globally, because in this region, I'm flowing up and to the left, to the right. So the flow is going like that. That's fine. In this region, the flow is down and to the left, so that's going that way. But now in these little triangular regions, it's opposite now, because here I'm flowing to the left and I'm flowing down. Flowing to the left, no, flowing up, because I'm below this null cline, so I'm up and to the left. And here I'm going to flow that away. So this now becomes an unstable fixed point. And so it says then that, you know, the result of strong competition is that one species is eliminated and one species survives with a lower value. You know, and the thing is that if there's no other species around, then the competition doesn't play a role. And so I'm driven back to like one species at density 1 or the other species at density 1. So that's the behavior in the limit of strong competition. And it turns out that this is actually a very active debate in ecology, which is like, how many species should exist in an ecology with many competing species? And so there's been a debate like, well, because of competition, very few species should remain. And so this is still actually a very open debate. And you know, this is a very, you know, trivial toy model that shows the same type of behavior. So that's the case of two species competition. Let's see. But now we can do the same kind of a game. So maybe raise the screen. I'm going to need it maybe in 5 more minutes, but raise the screen for now. Thank you. So now let's do the case of two species symbiosis. So I'm going to be a little bit lazy here, because you'll see that there's almost everything is the same. So I'm going to call now two species mutualism, or let's call it symbiosis. Sounds fancier. Symbiosis. So in this case, instead of fighting over a piece of grass, we say, oh, look, there's a piece of grass. Let's like sing kumbaya and, you know, something good will happen. So let's imagine this with a plus sign now. So when there is two species together, they help each other rather than hurt each other. And one can ask, well, what is the behavior of this dynamical system? So again, we do the same thing as before. We find the null clines, we find the fixed points, we infer the global behavior. And so the null clines, again, we're looking at the two null clines, a dot equals 0, b dot equals 0. And so the null cline a dot equals 0 is either a is equal to 0, or now b is equal to a minus 1. So let's just put a minus sign here. That's one null cline. The other null cline, b dot equals 0, is just same as before, and I just put a minus sign out in front here. So I'm being lazy to not rewriting the formulas over and over again. But so let's, and now let's draw this in the phase plane and try and figure out what the flow is going to look like. So again, it turns out that there's two different behaviors depending on when epsilon is less than 1 or epsilon is larger than 1. So again, I'm plotting. And actually, you know, let's imagine this is no longer 1 here, but let's say it's much bigger than 1. So let's say 10, for example, 10. Because of mutualism or symbiosis, it means the density can actually be larger than 1, and we'll see what it is. So let's assume that this is some number which is bigger than 1. So let's see, where am I? So for the a dot equals 0 null cline, so when, and now I'm lost, so let me just look at my notes. Yes, okay. Is that right? Yes, that is right. So here, for example, is 1, and here is 1. So now the a dot, so when a is, when, let's see, where am I? So when b is equal to, when a is equal to 1, b is equal to 0. When a increases, then that means that b increases as well. So it means that my curve is, my line is a straight line which is sloped that away. So my null cline is looking something like this. So this is the null cline a dot equals 0. And let me draw sort of the 45-degree line over here to help me. And again, the flow does the same thing as before. So like when a dot is equal to 0, the flow is like, this out of the way. So it's looking something like this. And similarly, the b dot equals 0 null cline is a curve. It's a line that's doing something like this. Is the null cline b dot equals 0. And again, the flow is down above it and up below it. And now we see, again, there is a fixed point. Yes, question?
I probably should have asked this on the last one, too. I'm not quite sure how we see that, like, on the null clines, the arrows always point towards them. Why, like the, how come with the a dot equals 0, it's always like this, and the b dot equals 0 is always like this?
Well, the point is that, first of all, you know, once I find a null cline, So on the null cline, A dot is equal to zero, so A is not changing. So by the definition of null cline, if I'm to one side of it, the flow of A will always be in the same direction throughout the entire null cline, or else it's not a null cline.
How come I can't do it that?
It could be, but it's just not in this particular case. Just from the formula itself, we just saw that, you know, when we went just on one side of it, the flow is back to the null cline, on the other side back in the other way. But you could have a null cline which was a diverging thing. That's certainly possible, but it's not, it doesn't happen here.
Do you see, is it like whether like the A dot ends up being positive or negative from that equation?
Right, exactly. That's all I'm doing, yes. But anyways, now let's look, now that we have the local behavior, let's look at the global behavior. So in this region, we have the flow is up and to the left. So in this region, by symmetry, we have flow which is down and to the right. In this region, the flow is to the right and up. So it's right and up. And here the flow is going like that. So this is actually a stable fixed point. So when there is weak mutualism, we all do a little bit better, but we just do a little bit better. And how much better we can actually, you know, calculate from the original equation. But you see that here is a fixed point 1, 1, and we're doing a little bit better by mutualism. Yes?
For this B dot equals zero line, you're plotting A equals B minus 1 over epsilon?
Mm-hmm.
How come, like, I would think when B equals 1, then you have B equals 0?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You're drawing it like, oh, I see.
No. Yeah, so this is the axis, B axis. Is the A axis. All right. When epsilon is bigger than one, so epsilon bigger than one means that this slope is less than plus one. And so this curve actually does something that looks like that. And this curve does something that looks like that. So this is the A dot equals zero. Null cline, this is the B dot equals zero null cline. Yes, question.
Another question about the axes. Why do we go from zero to 10 here and not from zero to one as we did earlier?
No, it's just that in the case of mutualism, the density could be larger than one. Because, you know, since we're helping each other, if we weren't helping each other, our density would be one. But if I'm helping you and you're helping me, then our density can be larger than one. So I'm just choosing some number bigger than one to illustrate where the null clines intersect and to find the fixed point. But the point is that as you change epsilon and increase it, you know, this curve goes down, this curve goes up, such that they never meet. Now there's no fixed point anymore, and it turns out that the flow is like that. And so Bob May, who is like the most famous mathematical ecologist of all time and who died maybe about 2 years ago, he called this an orgy of mutual satisfaction. So if you could bring down the slide again, I'm going to show you that plot as well. So hopefully it's going to show up. We didn't know there was sex ed as part of this class.
That's the first lesson.
Okay, so what I'm showing now is the case of mutualism. And so let's turn down the, you know, the mutualistic parameter. So this is showing again, you know, I'm plotting the flow diagram in the AB plane. And so when here I have my epsilon is 0.1, and you see there's a fixed point here. This is 1, and you see that the fixed point is a little bit larger than 1. So when there's weak mutualism, there is a non-zero fixed point. And it's stable, and you know, one looks at the stability, you know, one can look locally at the stability of the fixed point to ask, like, what is the dynamics close to that fixed point? But as I increase epsilon, so let's go up to, say, 0.5. Now, you see again that the flow is like converging on the 45-degree line, and it's down and to the left above, and it's up and to the right below. And so you see there's a fixed point here, and if you come here and take a look, this is around 2. So we're doing better by having more mutualism. And as I increase the mutualism even further, So this is now at 0.9. So our fixed point looks like it's like right here, which is around 10. So with like a mutualism parameter of 0.9, we're doing really better because now there's 10 times more of us in the population. But then if I increase it down to 1.1, kablooey, now we have this orgy of mutual satisfaction and we just go off to infinity. So that's the dynamical behavior of this two species mutualism model. And these two features of competition and mutualism are beginning to like exhaust the possibilities that exist in a true, in a real dynamical system. So the last example that I want to present is prey-predator dynamics. And maybe some of you have heard of the Lotka-Volterra model, maybe some people. And so let me say a little bit about Lotka-Volterra-like models because they're also, they have their own beauty associated with them. So I guess that's it for the slide for today. Thanks. So let me now go to Lotka-Volterra model.
Would there be any points in like a parasitic system?
Say it again?
Would there be a fixed point in a parasitic system?
What do you mean by parasitic system?
Minus epsilon b, but plus epsilon.
That's exactly prey-predator dynamics. That's what I'm going to talk about right now. Yeah. So let's talk about prey-predator dynamics, which is precisely what you want, is that one species left by itself will like multiply, but the other species feeds on the prey species. And so it does well when there's lots of prey. But if the prey are, there's not much of them, then the predators starve to death. And so it leads to a very beautiful oscillatory behavior. So this is prey-predator dynamics. Predator dynamics. So let me couch it in terms of things that we're all, most of us, I guess, are familiar with, which is rabbits and foxes. So I don't know how many of you have had experience with rabbits, but rabbits are goddamn stupid, right? You know, it's like when you're walking along and they're trying to run away from you, they'll run towards you, and then there is, whoops, I'm running towards you. And part of the reason that they're stupid, or maybe like one of the reasons they can be stupid, is that they reproduce like rabbits. They reproduce very quickly. So even though lots of them are killed off because they're run over by cars or, you know, caught by predators, they're reproducing rapidly. So let me call my prey species, let me call it A. And what is the differential equation for my prey? Well, left by themselves, they just multiply. So there's going to be A. And let me, for the sake of this discussion, let me assume there's no self-regulation so that if rabbits are left by themselves, I would just take over the universe. But then there is the predators, B. And the predators eat the rabbits. And so one way you can model that is by putting A, B here. So proportional to the density of rabbits, the density of foxes, you know, the rate at which rabbits will disappear is proportional to the density of foxes that are hunting them times the density of rabbits that are there to eat. And now with the foxes, well, if they have nothing to eat, they die. So let's just put in death. Foxes die if they have no food to eat. But they grow because they can eat rabbits. So that is what's called the Lotka-Volterra model. Volterra model.
What about the reproduction of foxes? Multiplication.
Well, so in some sense, you know, like you could say, well, what about and also the self-regulation of rabbits? I mean, we could put in a term here plus, you know, we could put like a minus A squared for self-regulation of rabbits and a minus B squared for self-regulation of foxes. We could put in a lot more terms in here. But in the spirit of minimalism, let's not worry about these first. We'll worry about them a bit later. But let's just look at this minimal model.
Figure out why A dot has a plus A, but B dot has a minus B.
Because the foxes, you know, the rabbits, they like there's an infinite supply of grass. And so they can just, if they're left by themselves, they don't have to worry about resources because there's an infinite amount of resource. So they just grow. The foxes need rabbits. So if there's no rabbits in the population, they just starve to death because there's nothing there for them to eat.
What is weird to me is that the infiniteness of the supply turns the minus to a plus, because you're saying that if you had, let's say you had another paper, you had three equations. One of them was for plants, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
So that A would turn into minus A?
Yeah, so, okay. I mean, you know, what you're now beginning to think about is like a model for a food web where you have the grass, you have like the first level of, you know, grass eaters and the meat eaters above them, and then you have to worry about this three species dynamics. So what I'm doing here is like trying to, you know, make a caricature, which is saying, let's forget about the grass, let's just assume it's infinite supply, and let's just look at the two next levels of the two next trophic levels of the prey, which is just eaten by the predator, and the predator which eats the prey and nothing else. But you know, you're trying to ask, like, what about putting in more realism into the model? And yes, it makes sense to put in more realism.
More realism is
okay.
I don't understand why A has a plus sign and B has a minus sign. You're saying that because they're dependent on the food, on the rabbit as their food,
right?
And they don't have it, they starve to death,
right?
But but at the same time, I'm kind of struggling to understand if your supply turns from infinity to a finite number, how mm-hmm. would the plus sign turn into a minus sign?
No, but there's no.
That's basically what you're saying, I think.
I'm not sure I get it. Like, where you're saying a plus sign is turned. Yes.
For a grass infinity.
Yes.
Plus A.
Right.
But the supply of rabbit for the fox is finite.
Right.
So minus B.
Right.
So the minus and plus sign is kind of, I don't understand.
No, but I mean, again, the thing is that let's just look at the case where there's no rabbits to eat, and you're a population of foxes. What's going to happen to you?
You're going to die.
So that's exactly what this term is, that with no bees, you're dying.
Okay.
But why the second term is the product of A, not just A?
Because the thing is that in order for like this interaction to occur, you actually need an interaction. A rabbit has to eat a fox in order that the fox's belly is full so that then they can mate and you can make more baby foxes.
Did I say that?
Yeah, so it's a two-body interaction that causes the foxes to reproduce. It's a two-body interaction that causes the rabbits to disappear. And again, this is a cartoon. This is not a realistic model. But the point is that this model is so simple that one can say some nice analytical things about it, and it has very beautiful dynamical behavior, which I guess I'm not going to get to today because it's 10:32. So I guess let me stop here and.